I'm Dorothy Green. Coming up next on King Stories, you will hear rarely documented accounts about the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Learn about his precocious teenage years, the hardships of being on the road more than 25 days out of the month, his last conversation just prior to being fatally struck down by a sniper's bullet, and the congressional investigation into his murder. Over the next hour, Julian Bond and other close friends and associates will share unforgettable stories about the private and public sides of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I'm Julian Bond. Welcome to King Stories, a documentary of provocative insights on the public and private sides of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. A champion of the poor and disenfranchised, Dr. King led the Montgomery bus boycott and focused world attention on the explicit racism and discrimination that black Americans lived with day to day. Dr. King, father of four and a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, achieved what Lincoln and Roosevelt could not. While heading up the civil rights movement, King vanquished social acceptance of black inferiority and bigotry in a way that's still significant. In this program, you will hear stories by the Reverend Larry Williams, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Mark Lane, Dick Gregory, David Garrow, and myself. All of our lives share a common thread with Martin Luther King Jr. Our stories begin with King's teenage years. From the eyes of a close friend who also shared a calling to the ministry, we learn about a rarely documented part of King's life. Reverend Larry Williams, pastor of Zion Hill Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia.
His name was Martin, having been changed officially from Michael. His daddy changed their name. They were Michael Luther King. And his daddy officially changed their name to Martin Luther King, the great Reformationist, Martin Luther. Yeah, that's what Reverend King. ML was always called by all the people who knew him, all the church people, just ML. That's all they ever called him. Martin was a name that started, which was his official name, that started developing during the time of the Civil Rights Movement. I met the ML around 1943. He must have been about 15, and I was about 19 or so when we first met. And you would imagine that a 19-year-old would not associate with a 15-year-old. But I was pretty popular around the church, that is Ebenezer Church, with the younger people. ML just kind of drew himself to me, and we developed a very intimate and very close relationship. And I noticed, looking back, even then, I noticed that he seemed to have been more mature for his years than most other 15-year-olds. He was driving a car at that time. You could drive, I think, around 15, and his daddy, Reverend King Sr., would let him drive. He was very interested in girls, and I was very popular. The guys called us Robinsons and Stevens. I think about it now. Robinson and Stevens is a company here in Atlanta, the wrecking crew. They pick up the wrecks. I was Robinson, ML was Stevens. That meant with reference to girls, here come Robinson and Stevens. That's what they named us. We would go around to other churches in Atlanta. We would kind of slip out sometime, slip out of Ebenezer, and his father wouldn't know it. And that went on for all the years of his college life, and ML would write me letters. We would write letters to each other, just like, I don't know, like you might be writing to your sweetheart. We'd write every week, and he would address the letter, maybe to me, Dr. Larry, which I wasn't even graduated from college, Dr. Larry H. Williams, and put up on the end, B.D., Ph.D., LL.D., through the mail. And I would address the letter to him up at Crozier using the same kind of a name, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., D.D., B.D., LL.D., in the mail. He would tell me about different things that he was doing. I remember when he first met Coretta Scott, he wrote me and told me about this fine chick he had met up at Boston, how she could sing. By Reverend King being the pastor of the church, ML was permitted to do some things that were not traditional. in the life of the church. I remember that very distinctly. When you start preaching, you know, you never preach in the main sanctuary. You have to preach in the basement, the first unit. So ML, they had the basement all with people down there and, you know, all set up for ML to preach his trial sermon. I remember seeing Miss King. I just look at her, and I don't know, just the look of how proud she was. And of course, her daddy, too. I can look at Reverend King, and he was kind of outspoken. You could always tell where he was, but he was so proud. But anyway, when ML, just before he got ready to preach, I remember that Reverend King, he got up and said, wait, says, well, it's just too crowded down here. And so we got to go upstairs. That meant he couldn't preach it in the basement, had to go upstairs. So the deacon chairman of the deacon board was named Deacon Edwards. I can remember him saying, well, Brother Pastor, say, you know, it's traditional for the preacher to make his trial sermon in the basement. He said, yeah, but it's too crowded. I can remember he telling the congregation, everybody, to leave the basement going up. And I saw M.L. with his mother. I can remember seeing him walking up the steps with his hand on his mother's shoulder. And looked like he was mildly embarrassed. I mean embarrassed, because he was given a privilege here that others before him had been denied. By 47, his daddy had started turning the church over to him. All the summer, he would just tell him, see, Reverend King, he ran the church. He could say what he wanted to. Said, ML was going to be here all the summer. See, he would be just like the pastor. So I think that being given this opportunity early helped to make him develop and act more adult-like. He was seemingly a little advanced for his years in terms of development, the things that he talked about, his attitude. He wanted to be an adult. Reverend King would literally let him run the church. That meant that he was running the church as pastor, whatever he wanted to do. And he was just 19 or so. No, he wasn't 19. Because he finished Morehouse, I believe, in 48. So he wasn't 19, by 17.
Reverend Larry Williams died in 2003. His brother-like friendship flourished throughout King's college years and into his early manhood.
A few years later, Dr. King started his ministry in Montgomery, where he met Reverend Ralph Abernathy and developed a lifelong friendship. Known as the Civil Rights Twins, King and Abernathy crusaded for freedom across America for over a decade. Appointed SCLC director by Dr. King, Reverend Abernathy is pastor of West Hunter Street Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia.
I met Dr. King first in 1954, and fortunately, he had to bring my guest preacher. Martin Luther King was kind enough to drop Dr. Johns off at my home, and so consequently, I invited him to join us in a meal. We were just in our 20s, early 20s, at that particular time. Early the next morning, the only form of integration that had taken place in Montgomery, a black preacher was allowed 15 minutes to speak on a radio station, preach a sermon on the radio station. It was housed in the Jefferson Davis Hotel. I was the preacher for that particular month. Dr. King called me and thanked me for the sermon, and we agreed to get together at the close of the services, and we were together all the way from Montgomery to Memphis. We would rise early every morning, do some exercise and get cleaned up and dressed for another day, fighting an evil system of segregation and discrimination. We would start marching, demonstrating and protesting, and we would pause about 12 o'clock to have lunch. We would often eat from a grocery store. We would stop on these highways, just highways that would lead through the swamps of Mississippi and Alabama, and get a jar of pig ears, pig feet, Martin Luther King loved pig feet. And we would go into the afternoon with conferences and planning sessions and strategy sessions with our staff. And we would go into mass meetings with people of the city. Thousands of people would come to hear our words and what we had to say. And we would always share the podium together. He wanted to speak for us, and we would complain about that. We would debate about that. It's the closest we ever got to an argument. And he would say, "Let me speak first, because you are a better speaker than I am, and you can arouse the people and let the people go away determined not to ride the bus and determined to carry out what we want them to carry out." And I would always yield. He would always win, and I would let him speak first. And he was an eloquent speaker. I can hear him saying now, "We are tired. We are tired. We are tired. We are tired of being pushed out of the glittering sunlight of life's July and left standing in the piercing chill of an alpine November. We are tired." And the women around me would say, "What is that boy talking about?" And one lady would say, "Well, I don't know what he is talking about, but I sure do like what he's saying." He had a deep sense of humor. Dr. King would always tell these stories about Hilly Thomas, the late Reverend Hilly Thomas. He said he was teaching a class one evening, a grammar class for in-service pastors, and ordered that they could improve in their grammar. Dr. Thomas was in his class. He said, "Class, if you came home at 2 o'clock in the morning and you knocked on the door and your wife answered the door and said to you, 'Who is it?' would you answer, 'It is I,' or 'It is me?" Dr. Hilly Thomas said, "Mr. Teacher, let me answer that question. Let me answer that question." And he said, "Okay, Dr. Thomas, you may answer the question. If I went out and stayed until 2 o'clock in the morning and my wife came to the door and I knocked on the door and she said, 'Who is it?' and I would say, 'It's me, baby.'" He would always keep you laughing. And he was just the strongest, physically strongest man I have ever came in contact with. He could wrestle and win all the wrestling tussles that we would have. He could swim, and he could outswim anybody. At the very, very same time, he could outthink anybody. It was at Quitman County, Mississippi, when the Poor People's Campaign was conceived. They served some little children, 4 and 5 years old children, a meal at a Head Start program. And they only had a cracker to give each of those children. And Dr. King literally cried, and I cried with him. And we decided that we were going to organize the Poor People's Campaign. He talked about bringing poor whites, poor blacks, and poor browns and poor yellows together in this nation, all forming one coalition, which which would be the most powerful thing in this country. The power structure could not tolerate that any longer. Mr. Hoover never liked him. He called him the most notorious liar in the world. And so the FBI was against us. They bugged our homes. They tapped our phones. And when we were checking hotels, they would have even those hotel rooms bugged. And they had been telling him that they were going to get him. And people, they were calling other people, telling them that they were going to get him. He told me when we got ready to go to the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C., and we had set the dates, but I had a revival here in the West 100th Street Baptist Church. And I told him just before he was assassinated, Martin, I cannot go because I had to have this revival. And he turned to me and said, David. He always called me David, which is my real name, biblical name, and not Ralph, but David. David, I would not think of going to Washington without you. And I will not go to Washington without you. If you cannot go then, we will have to get other dates. I want you to go to West 100th Street Baptist Church. I want you to say to them, I have a greater revival. A revival that will revive the soul of this nation. Will you do that? And I said, yes, I will do it. And he said, okay, are you ready to go? And I said, yes. And he said, well, get your coat. And I said, oh, let me put some Aramis on because you have just finished shaving and you have used your Aramis. And I want to smell good like you. And he said, I will be waiting for you on the balcony. And before I could get the Aramis up to my face, I heard what sounded like a firecracker. And I jumped, and I could see only his feet. And I rushed to his side, and he died in my arms. On the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, April the 4th, 1968. He was just a wonderful person that had the ability to face life and face death unafraid. And he made me so brave and courageous. Yes, they killed the dreamer, but they will never kill the dream.
The vivid memory of Dr. King dying in his arms would remain etched in Abernathy's mind until his death in 1990. You're listening to King Stories. I'm Dorothy Green. Coming up, the investigation into the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. when King Stories returns right after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to King Stories. I'm Dorothy Green. We are exploring little-known facts about the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our host, Julian Bond.
The investigation by the U.S. Congress into the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. jointly was spearheaded by noted lawyer and author Mark Lane. Once a freedom rider himself, Lane is the co-author of the controversial book, Codename Zorro, which documents his investigation into King's murder.
The New York Post and the New York Times, I was living in New York at the time, started to report about some activity in the South and the emergence of a new young black leader named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I think this was the first time anybody in the New York City area had heard of Dr. King and the committee of ministers around him, the committee which he had been chosen to lead. At that time, Bayard Rustin, who was working with A. Philip Randolph, invited Dr. King to New York City, and he had a little meeting for him, very, very small meeting, in a hall which wasn't so small. And I heard about it and decided to go to this meeting, and we heard Dr. King speak. In addition to being so moved by what he said, I was outraged at the organization of the meeting, which brought together perhaps 30 people to hear Dr. King. And when it was over, Reverend Eugene St. Clair Callender, who was a minister of the Mid-Harlem Community Parish at that time and my closest friend, Gene Callender and I sat down and said, why don't we invite him back and have a real rally so the people of New York can really hear him? So Eugene Callender and I organized the first rally at which Dr. King spoke in New York City. It was 125th Street and 7th Avenue, just outside of the Teresa Hotel. And Sugar Ray Robinson had a bar down the block, and he assisted us in making electricity available. That was the site of the rally. Tens of thousands of people came to hear Dr. King speak. I remember how he closed. He said, well, now I must close. Now I must leave you. And it was almost unanimous in the crowd. Everybody said, no, no, no. People just didn't want it to end. It was sort of like a Beethoven symphony. You think it's going to end, and then there's a little bit more, and everybody's so grateful for that little bit more. And the little bit more here was, my country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing, from every mountainside. And then he traced the mountains around the country, the Appalachians, the mighty Rockies. He traced them all around the country, and finally to Old Stone Hill in Mississippi and the red clay hills of Alabama. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And everybody went crazy. Those are the high points, I guess, of my memories of Dr. King. The low point, which is equally dramatic in my mind, was hearing about the speech given on the floor of the United States Senate, not understanding the context then. Now I do, because I've investigated the efforts by the FBI to destroy Dr. King. The speech was given on the floor of the United States Senate on March 29th, 1968, less than a week before the assassination. Dr. King had, of course, embarked upon a whole new program in the last months. It began, Ralph Abernathy told me, when they were traveling down to the islands and Dr. King was going to write a book. And he carried with him two large suitcases. One had all of his clothing, the other one had all of his books and papers. And they sat down at the airport restaurant while waiting for the plane, and they ordered food. And Dr. King went over to the newsstand. No matter how many books and newspapers and magazines he had, he would go to the newsstand and buy more, always reading. And he went over the newsstand and he came back with a copy of Ramparts magazine. People may recall that picture of a Vietnamese child crying. Napalm bombs have dropped, and there she is. She's naked, a little girl, crying. And Dr. King looked at it and went through the magazine. And then the steak arrived, and Ralph started eating the steak, and Dr. King just pushed the plate away. And Ralph said, doesn't it taste good? And he said, Ralph, nothing will ever taste good to me ever again until we speak out against this war in Vietnam. He said, I know the advisors have been saying we're going to lose our support. We have to stay in the area of civil rights. Dr. King made an analysis. The disproportionate number of blacks in the military, and above all, the disproportionate number of blacks in the U.S. military who were dying in Vietnam. And this was a way, a transition to reach those who were concerned about civil rights. I believe that when Dr. King rallied that support of young white kids, of older principled people who were against the war in Vietnam, of the entire peace movement, and the entire civil rights movement, when he built that coalition, which he did not call the Rainbow Coalition, but that's when it was born, when he built that coalition, he signed his death warrant. And one of the ways he was going to focus on all of these issues was the Poor People's Campaign, the March to Washington. And he said, we have to address the economic injustice in America, which is at the root of all of the problems. Some people have millions, other people are homeless. Dr. King, as we look back, was the first person really to focus on the question of homelessness long before it became on the agenda for America. It was on the agenda for him. And so he said, we're moving to Washington, D.C. Poor people from all over this country, homeless, minorities, all poor people will be invited, and we will reside. It will not be a demonstration or rally. We will move in here. We'll pitch our tents. We'll build little communities. And we will stay here until we revamp the economic system of America and justice flows like the mighty rivers. That upset a lot of people. And then in the middle of this poor people's campaign, this tremendous crusade to come to Washington, D.C., Dr. King was asked to go down yet again to Memphis, Tennessee, and support the sanitation workers, 98% of whom were black, who were demonstrating in Memphis. And when he was asked to go there, Andy Young told me that he advised Dr. King not to go. He said, we're in the middle of this massive campaign. It's going to take all our organization. This is a distraction. Don't go. And Dr. King said, do you know what their slogan is, Andy? They're not asking for more money. They have to urinate and defecate in the cabs of their trucks because they're not allowed into places where white people go. He said, you know what their slogan is? They're not asking for better hours. They're not asking for higher wages. That's not the heart of it. They say, I am a man. This is a cry for human dignity. Now, Andy, we have to go. And he went down there. Andy made and others made reservations at the Holiday Inn Rivermont, which is the closest thing, was the closest thing to a big hotel just outside of Memphis. One of the things about Holiday Inn Rivermont, which was not a matter of concern for Dr. King, was the security was really good in that it was a giant building far away from other buildings. Once he got into that building, he went in the elevator up to your room, and there was no way anyone could get to you easily. The FBI knew that. J. Edgar Hoover began a campaign to drive Dr. King out of the Holiday in Rivermont and to drive him not only out of there, but into the Lorraine Motel, which was built somewhat like a shooting gallery. That is to say, it was in a depressed area physically. Across the street, there were a lot of old rooming houses with windows looking right out. There was no central entrance into the Lorraine Motel rooms. It was just like the kind of motel they have all around this country, an upstairs and a downstairs, two floors, and you could be shot from 100 different locations right across the street. And that was the plan of the FBI. And so the FBI began a massive campaign in Memphis saying, material which they gave to their pets in the news media, radio and TV, newspapers, magazines. Dr. King says he's a great leader for integration in America. He says he likes to identify with poor people. But when he comes to Memphis, he stays in the white-owned, all-white Holiday Inn Rivermont. Why doesn't he go to the Lorraine Motel? Lorraine Motel is owned by black people. Why does Dr. King turn his back on poor black people trying to make a living? Over and over and over. People down there, including Andy Young, and the advance party got a little nervous and raised the question with Dr. King. And Dr. King said, well, we always integrate hotels wherever we go. This is a kind of a problem for black-owned places, but this is what we're doing. We're integrating hotels where blacks have not gone before. That's what we go. That's what the Freedom Ride is about. That's what all these movements are about, to break down these barriers. But I leave it to you, he said. And then the committee down there kept on hearing this stuff. And then on the floor of the United States Senate, a speech was made. I'm going to read just a few words from the speech. Talking about Dr. King, this person said, if this self-seeking rabble-rouser is allowed to go through with his plans here in Washington, Washington may well be treated the same kind of violence, destruction, looting, and bloodshed. And then he goes on to speak. King intends to create a black hole of despair with people packed together. This is the Poor People's Campaign. Packed together with pigs and chickens in a shanty town, lacking sanitation. Surely he must know that to change hearts, it is not necessary to turn stomachs. It can be assumed, however, that the Messiah himself will not share the squalor he plans, and that instead he will be conducting a lay-in at a posh Washington hotel to dramatize some imaginary discrimination there. In other words, discrimination in Washington is imaginary, especially at the hotels. But get the phrase, a lay-in. This was part of at J. Edgar Hoover's sexpionage program against Dr. King, and again, a posh hotel. This speech, delivered on the floor of the Senate, was written at the direction of J. Edgar Hoover by technicians in the FBI, given to a member of the Senate who utilized the floor of the United States Senate to help drive Dr. King out of the Holiday Inn Rivermont into the Lorraine Motel. The speech was delivered in the United States Senate on Friday, March 29, 1968, by Robert C. Byrd, leader of the United States Democratic Party in the United States Senate. And that speech had its effect, with the comments on the floor of the Senate and the other FBI written and inspired broadcasts in Memphis. The impetus was too great, and the leadership of Dr. King's movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, moved his reservations from the Holiday Inn Rivermont to the Lorraine Motel, where he was killed by those working with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And then the blame was placed upon James Earl Ray, who, in my view, played no knowing part at all in the assassination of Dr. King and has been in jail since that time.
In 1998, James Earl Ray died while serving a 99-year sentence for the murder of Dr. King. After his death, Dr. King's widow, Coretta Scott King, issued a statement, quote, "This is a tragedy, not only for Mr. Ray and his family, but also for the entire nation. America will never have the benefit of Mr. Ray's trial, which would have produced new revelations about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., as well as established the facts concerning Mr. Ray's innocence."
Sharing in the investigation and authorship of the publication Codename Zorro is social activist, comedian, and nutritionist Dick Gregory.
I met Dr. King in late 62, early 63. I met him from a celebrity standpoint. They were soliciting entertainers to come to various areas, not as much to do benefits, because when you come into rural Alabama or rural Mississippi, the people that would come out to see you have no money. And so it wasn't that they were saying, "Would you please come down so we can have this great fundraiser?" They were saying, "Would you please come down to help us validate our legitimacy?" I know there was a conspiracy in the killing of Martin Luther King. There's 10,000 ways to explain it, starting with James Earl Ray, who admitted that he did it. But we have to say, well, back up for a minute. Why did he admit it? 24 hours a day, he was under these floodlights. And no one's asked, why was the FBI guarding him? That wasn't a federal case. That the lights on him were so hot that the FBI agent on the third shift had a nervous breakdown. And when you look at James Earl Ray, there is not a more ignorant, dumb, white criminal that lived in America than him. If you look at his life of crime, he had never committed a crime that literally he wasn't apprehended within 30 minutes. Now, how do you go from little petty stuff that you can't get away with to pulling off almost the crime of the century? And then they were very interested in how they got him caught. So nobody would even ask any questions that he did it. Scotland Yard caught him. And they sent him through the Heathrow Airport in the heat of the summer with a long overcoat on down to his knees. Well, I mean, I ain't even no cop, but if I thought about saving the Queen, I would have grabbed him. But then when you start asking James some questions, then you really find out how dumb he was. The warden of the Missouri State Penitentiary had been the warden of the Atlanta Federal Jail, just moved there about 2 weeks before James escaped. But before he became warden of the Atlanta Federal Jail, for you younger folks that's listening, we had a U-2 plane that was shot down. That was a spy plane that had an American pilot on it named Francis Powers. He was supposed to have committed suicide, and how you can justify that in a Christian society. But he didn't, so I guess he was a good Christian. He said, "Man, I ain't taking this stuff." And the Russians caught him, And Eisenhower was president. He was so sure that that chump had committed suicide, Ike denied. No, we don't have no, we don't know nobody. And they paraded him across the TV screens. Well, one day we made a deal to bring him back home. We swapped with a Russian spy we had caught named Abel for Francis Power. And the guy who made the swap on the bridge for us was the guy who ended up being the Atlanta warden of the federal jail, and also the warden of the jail where James L. Ray escaped. So it's obvious that, you know, he's more than just a warden. Now, you talk to James, you say, well, James, how did you escape the Missouri State Penitentiary in Jefferson City, famous for Sonny Liston, famous for no one before James L. Ray or since have ever escaped from the Missouri State Penitentiary. James, how did you do it? Wow, here's how he did it. James worked in the bakery, baked bread. He's in the yard one day, and a group of inmates walked up and said, James, how would you like to escape? And James said, oh, wow, yeah, man, when we going? And they said, we not, you are. And he was so dumb, he went, I mean, can you imagine you being in jail, and there's going to be a jailbreak, and some people come and tell you, you didn't even have it on your mind, we're going to break out of jail. Say, when? Say, oh, we not, you are. Oh, you mean you love me so much, you're going to fix it so I can escape? And here's how they did it. They baked bread not just for the Missouri State Penitentiary, but other state agencies in the area. They put it on a truck. They loaded it in bread boxes, and the guards loaded it onto a truck. They locked the door of the truck, and the truck pulled out to deliver the bread. The day James Earl Ray escaped, they put him in the bread box and put a row of bread over him, and nobody to this day have ever asked one simple question. How did the guards pick up a bread box with a human being in it, a grown man, and didn't know the difference in the weight? James got in the truck. Truck took off. James got out the box, brushed the crumbs off of him, but the truck was moving too fast for him to jump off, and he noticed something else. They forgot to lock the door. And just when he started getting worried about how would he get off that truck, the truck pulled into a creeping halt, drove off the highway into a wooded area, and James jumped off the truck. You see, when they get ready to stalk you, to pin a murder on you, you don't know. You're just honest and innocent, and you're just doing little things that you think is right. I mean, people say, you need to be here at such and such place. Oh, show up at Memphis. If James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King, my mother shot Martin Luther King. But they made one mistake when they killed Martin. They killed the baby, and they'll pay. And if this nation don't get to the bottom of it, this nation will pay. And if you don't believe it, just go back through history and see what have always happened when you mess with the head of the anointed.
Listening to King Stories. I'm Dorothy Green. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize winner David Garrell shares riveting insights into Dr. King's personal life story. When King Stories returns, right after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to King Stories. I'm Dorothy Green. Today, we are looking at the public and private sides of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our host, Julian Bond.
David Garrow is an undisputed scholar on civil rights activism. His book, Bearing the Cross, is a comprehensive account of Dr. King and the civil rights movement that earned him a Pulitzer Prize.
Initially, I first began writing about Dr. King and the civil rights movement largely as an academic enterprise. My first book on Selma and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was very much a political science piece of analysis. My actual emotional identification and attachment to Dr. King really developed during my early work on Bearing the Cross when I had the opportunity first to read all of the dozens of exceptionally powerful unpublished sermons from the latter part of King's life that are available in Atlanta but nowhere else. And then also when I started having the opportunity to travel around and talk with dozens and then dozens more of the people that had actually worked with King. And I think far and away the two most emotionally powerful and strengthening experiences that I've had during my work on Dr. King and the movement was that exposure to the people and that exposure to the sermons and to the incredibly strong spiritual strength and religious faith of King's that comes through in those sermons more so than it comes through anywhere else. Dr. King was someone who didn't enjoy dealing with competition or conflict at all. King was someone who had no egotistical desire at all to be a famous person or to be a leader. King, as I think virtually everyone who was close to him emphasizes, was a very basically humble and self-effacing person, someone who always wanted to share credit and glory with others and never wanted to draw the spotlight or draw praise to himself. And so when other civil rights leaders, particularly the NAACP leadership, would criticize King behind his back or would object even to his face to some things he was doing or advocating, King was not someone who would get into petty shouting matches or arguments. He would generally just turn his head, turn the other cheek, if you will, and avoid it. And some of King's advisors, Bayard Rustin in particular, people who were much more sort of combative, much more emotionally used to the level of political infighting, would get very unhappy with King, that he wasn't interested in contesting those sorts of things. But King had, a very deep, very firm psychological belief that anger and hate and negative feelings are internally destructive, that the foremost victim of hate and anger is not the target of your hate or anger, but is you yourself. It's spiritually destructive to oneself as a human being to get caught up in negative emotions. I think the other thing that's very important to appreciate about King in that interpersonal way is that King was someone who found it almost impossible to speak harshly, to discipline someone, even members of his staff who'd gotten something wrong or made fairly serious errors. King was able to bring himself to fire really only one or two people over the course of 10 years, and he was very fundamentally gentle and forgiving of people, that he would always look for the best, even when some of his more immediate aides would say to him, we ought to get rid of that person. King would always look for the best in people. King was someone who realized almost from the beginning of his public involvement in Montgomery in 1955-1956 that he would be killed at one point, sooner or later, as a result of that leadership role into which he had been cast. And he had that attitude, had that realization for perfectly accurate, perfectly rational reasons, because even in that very early stage in Montgomery, he was getting dozens upon dozens of death threats. A bomb was thrown at his house no more than 8 or 9 weeks into the Montgomery boycott. And so King, very early on, accepted the likelihood of death in a very basic way, and he made his spiritual peace with that realization in the second month of the Montgomery boycott, when in religious faith terms he had the experience of realizing that that was part of his mission and part of his calling, that giving of himself to the movement, to the black freedom struggle, was not simply going to be a matter of 18 or 19 hours a day, but that what he was being asked to give to the movement was his life, period, literally. That understanding of his calling, of his fate, undergirds King's very calm courage throughout the ensuing 12 or 13 years. I think some people may be able to recall from memory the picture of King after he was stabbed in Harlem in 1958 by a deranged woman with a letter opener. And King sitting there very calmly, very contentedly, not a pained or worried expression on his face at all, with this knife sticking out of his chest. And the people who were with him at that time were all really sort of stunned that in the immediate aftermath of this stabbing, that King, the victim, was the calmest person in the place. And one sees that time and time again when King is faced with life-threatening situations. There's an experience in 1962 in Birmingham when a young white Nazi comes running up on the stage where King is speaking and sort of draws back and punches him in the temple. And King doesn't run away. King doesn't swing back. King just stands there. And it's other people who then restrain the fellow. But King goes forward. King refuses to press charges. The city police, even in Birmingham, press charges on their own to get rid of the guy. But King's calmness under fire, under assault, is repeatedly remarkable. Even in the later years, in 1965 and then even in Memphis in 1968, King is very calmly accepting of the fact that sooner or later he believes he will be killed without question. It's his first reaction when he learns of John Kennedy's death in 1963. That's what's going to happen to me, too. King, I think it's quite fair to say, felt considerable guilt, particularly in the years after 1962, 1963, at not being able to spend more time with his family, particularly spend more time with his children, and also felt very guilty about not being able to put more time into his church, into spending time with people at Ebenezer Baptist Church, because King felt torn. He, in a very deep way, felt that the church and his family ought to be the center of his life, and emotionally he wanted that. But at the same time, the demands and the requests of the movement were so huge and so almost all-encompassing that he found himself in the position of being on the road, of being involved in the movement, 27, 28 days out of any given month. And he eventually came to the, I think, rather reluctant and painful conclusion that the movement was a higher calling, that the movement was more important, and that even if it meant at times hurting his family, spending less time with them, that part of his calling and part of his obligation, and a painful part of it, was that the movement had to come first, and that part of what was uniquely asked of him by his faith and by his calling was to put his own personal preferences aside and to give of himself to a degree greater than he actually wanted to give. And I think that people need to appreciate that level of sacrifice that was asked of King and how draining and painful it is for someone to be asked, to be called to that extent, and that it exacted a price not only on King, but that it exacted a price on those around him as well.
When the Atlanta lunch counter demonstrations came to a successful conclusion in the summer of 1961, the adults called a meeting to explain the agreement that had been made to the public, an agreement that we students disagreed with. It said that lunch counters wouldn't integrate until after the schools integrated, and then only if there was no violence attendant to the integration of Atlanta's public schools. Well, it was a packed house. There were people angry that the one thing was dependent on the other, people who hadn't shopped downtown for almost a year and a half. But then Martin Luther King Jr. got up and preached on leadership. He said, you have to trust your leadership, no matter what it does. And he lifted the audience up, and he let them down. He lifted them up, he let them down, he lifted them up. Then he let them down again, and they, not knowing they'd been let down for the last time, applauded, and the meeting was over, walked out of the church. It was the most remarkable example of crowd control and of soothing people's ruffled spirits, and one of the best speeches I'd ever heard Martin Luther King Jr. give. Thank you for joining us for King Stories. I'm Julian Bond.
The interviews in this program were conducted in 1988. Reverend Larry Williams, Reverend Ralph David Abernathy, and James Earl Ray are all deceased. Our host, Julian Bond, died in 2015. King Stories is supported by a grant from the District of Columbia Commission on the Arts and Humanities and Key Love Botanica. I'm Dorothy Green, executive producer. Editor, Eleanor Hart. Post-production editor, Christopher Downing. Musician, Wason Jones. Associate producer and sound design, Pat Macedi Miller. For more information, you can visit us at kingstories.org.